Now, let's move on to the most exciting part, speed reading techniques. As we discussed earlier in the podcast, the key to speed reading is to see groups of words at a time. There are two powerful techniques to achieve this. The first one is space reading, where instead of focusing on the words themselves, we direct the gaze to the spaces between the words. This simple shift can significantly increase your reading speed. It might seem strange at first, but it's incredibly effective. It's almost like doubling my reading speed overnight. Here's how to start. Begin by looking at the space between two words. Gradually transition to looking at the spaces between three words, then four, and so on. Initially, don't worry about comprehending the text. Focus solely on developing the habit. Now try to do that for one of your reading materials. Start by focusing on the space between two words, then move on to three, and then four, and so on. Get your eyes accustomed to doing this with all type of text, from lengthy articles to social media posts. You know that perfectionist attitude where you keep delaying everything because it's not perfect yet? The moment you stop doing anything, just waiting for the stars to align, and then you could start. That's exactly where I am right now. I started this podcast to learn about how to create a life I would cherish, something I would be proud of. And God knows I'm doing my best to learn and grow, but it feels like I never have enough time to read, summarize, and discuss these topics in the best, most perfect way. I finished recording and editing an episode about how to speed read, and as I got to the last few minutes of it, I just hated it. It was something like what you just heard at the beginning, and that to me didn't feel good enough, valuable enough for you. And it hit me late last night that perhaps documenting my journey, my progress, and the challenges I face in pursuing my goals might be more valuable. Maybe even more valuable than that episode I didn't share. It's not that I think my life is more interesting than a best-selling speed-reading book, but simply that I couldn't bring it to life as effectively as the author did. I feel like my disarray, my struggles, and my quest to find my path could offer something meaningful to you. I certainly hope so. So, what have I been up to? Apart from spending a lot of time reading, summarizing, recording, and editing that book, I've started a couple of new ones. I hope to be able to share insights from the book 0 to 1, Notes on Startups or How to Build the Future by Peter Thiel with you very soon. The other one is a book called Million Dollar Weekend, The Surprisingly Simple Way to Launch a 7-Figure Business in 48 Hours by Noah Kagan. My reading choices reflect and probably give you an idea of what I want the first step in this whole journey to be, creating a business as soon as possible. Why as soon as possible, you ask? Well, I'm on summer vacation, at least the final days of it, and I want to make the most of this time. By the time the year begins, I want to have a head start so I can continue building on something I've already started. I do have a business idea of what I want to do, but I feel overwhelmed by the scope. I need help, but I'm unsure who to turn to or how to find them. I believe creating a few samples of my product is crucial so that anyone who joins me will understand the quality I aim for. I'm also definitely doing many things at once. My business, this podcast, and Reels. This reminds me of something I read in 0 to 1. Let me get it out right now. So, process trumps substance. When people lack concrete plans to carry out, they use formal rules to assemble a portfolio of various options. This describes American today. In middle school, we're encouraged to start hoarding extracurricular activities. In high school, ambitious students compete even harder to appear omnicompetent. By the time a student gets to college, he's spent a decade curating a bewilderingly diverse resume to prepare for a completely unknowable future. Come what may, he's ready for nothing in particular. And yet, I feel like each thing I do is important in its own right, but also reinforces the principal thing. My business should be the main focus, but to build it, I need to learn and synthesize what I learned from reading through this podcast. And the Reels help in building an audience. So aren't all of these necessary for this one thing I want to do? Or am I just finding excuses not to start? And that takes me to starting. I initially wanted to build a platform from scratch, but my coding skills are basic, if not absent. HTML, CSS, a little bit of Python. It would take ages to do it all myself. And I'm hesitant to pay for platforms like Squarespace or WordPress for now. So I figured I could do something else. Using social networks like Telegram to build a community and share my product. While this approach might not be ideal for creating a company, I see it as a training ground, you know? I'll strive to make it great and differentiate it from the competition, but my focus now is more to start and learn how to build a startup. So I thought I'll start with a beta version, with a few samples, and most importantly, the community, and gradually build the content over time by building something more feedback enriched and improving the product over time, and hopefully find people who want to join me in this pursuit and help create the best product possible. Alex Hormozi suggests that the beta version should be free to gather testimonials and feedback. That's my plan, but the thing is, I'm still struggling to start. I want to create a product first, but feel I lack the time and resources. I'm considering building the community this summer while people are more available, but doubts persist. What if it's not good enough? What if I need to hire people first? What if I can't price things correctly? What if? So many questions, so much overthinking, but what I really need to do is start and improve as I go. I'm also scared. Scared of failing and, oddly enough, scared of succeeding. I fear wasting my summer, not being present with my family and not making the most of these moments. But what if I'm already missing out by overthinking? Wouldn't I be more present if I felt I was doing the right things? Wouldn't I enjoy the little moments more if I felt I was on the right path? You know what? Enough with the questions. I'm going to, as Denzel Washington put God first, and I'm going to start. I'll adopt Noah Kagan's now not how approach and see where that leads me. If it doesn't work out, I can always return to my current path, right? Now that we've seen all of that, let me share with you a few things I really enjoyed this week. First, a book on the psychology of sales. It's something I've started sometime last year because I was eager to understand the art and psychology behind pricing and sales, but since that was not my main read, I never got to end in it, and I don't think I'll get to do it very soon either. I recently skimmed through it again in search of information on how to price my product. While I didn't find exactly what I was looking for, reading some of the pages made me realize how the psychology of sales is one of the most fascinating things I got to come across. For example, there's the fact that people often have a poor grasp of what things should actually cost. Listen to this. Imagine you are asked to heft a suitcase and guess its weight. How accurate would your guess be? Not very, most would admit. The arm muscles and brain and eye just aren't wired to gauge pounds or kilograms. And he goes on to discuss as an intriguing scenario. Imagine you're at an auction where the only task is to declare how much the suitcase is worth to you in dollars and cents, without any knowledge of what others might bid. In this situation, it's almost impossible to determine a precise value. He says, it's not the easiest thing to attach a price to something with no clear market value. You may end up wondering whether your top price is any more sharply defined than the other two guesses. One of the running themes of price psychology is that judgments of monetary value have much in common with sensory judgments like weight or brightness. Psychophysicists determined that people are acutely sensitive to differences and not so sensitive to absolute values. Anyways, if you have some spare time, I highly recommend the book Priceless: The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It by William Poundstone. Another topic I found compelling this week is the importance of supporting a partner's dream and ambitions in a relationship. This insight comes from one of my all-time favorite podcasts, Founders by David Senra. The story features Rosalie Sharp, the wife of Isidore Sharp, the founder of the Four Seasons hotel chain. Here's what Rosalie says, or at least writes. I would like to claim I had a hand in my husband's great success, but if I did, it was only because I kept quiet and didn't tell the truth about my fears for some of his schemes, Rosalie writes. Like the summer days in 1961, and just for context, this is me talking, the chain was created in 1960. So, like the summer's days in 1961, when we drove up to the corner of Eglinton Avenue and Leslie Street in Toronto, to a hilly meadow of tall grass. Here, said Issy, is the site for the second hotel, the Inn on the Park. What do you think? There was not another building in sight. Trucks were turning into a municipal garbage dump across the road, and just then, a CPR freight train roared by the property. I thought, what can he be thinking? Real hotels are always downtown, usually handy to the railroad station, and have regal names like Royal York, King Edward, and Prince George. Wisely, however, she kept her doubts to herself, and did so again when he told her his aim was to make the name Four Seasons synonymous with luxury like Rolls-Royce. My most valuable contribution to his success, she writes, has been my silence. And I would like to be that kind of supportive wife to my future husband, someone who believes in him even when things are tough. I want to be the person he can count on to calm his fears, extinguishes the flames of his self-doubt, and remind him of his strength when he's struggling. And when my own worries can make things harder for him, I'll choose to keep quiet, not because I'm holding back, but because sometimes the best support is just being there without adding any extra pressure. The third thing is a lesson about what makes a video not just watchable, but utterly captivating from the YouTuber, filmmaker, and independent journalist Johnny Harris. If you've ever watched one of his videos, sometimes even when the topic isn't your usual cup of tea, you've likely felt that magnetic pull of his storytelling, and you'd have to agree that Johnny is very good at what he does, and that he has mastered the art of grabbing your attention and holding it for as long as possible. This week, I revisited a video that unpacks the formula behind Johnny's viral successes, using powerful visual evidence, or visual anchors, paired with brief context segment, or from the viewer perspective, experience it and understand it. According to Johnny Harris, visual anchors are things that you can put your camera out that exist in the world that show whatever it is you're trying to say. Visual anchors are everything. What's truly fascinating is that sometimes these visual anchors alone can carry an entire video, even without much context. How does this work? Well, it's all about experience. Before we understand something intellectually, we first experience it emotionally and visually. Strong visual anchors tap into this instinctual process, giving us a gut-level understanding of the subject matter. However, it's important to use them correctly, as unrelated visuals can easily confuse the audience. Johnny also leveraged this by guiding our focus, literally telling us, look at this thing. The simple directive is far more powerful than it seems. It actually taps into a concept we studied in psychiatry called joint attention, where individuals focus on the same thing, facilitating communication and understanding. It's a basic human behavior, and Johnny uses it effectively to keep viewers engaged. In essence, when Johnny says, look at this thing, he's creating a shared movement of focus, a connection that primes us to absorb information in a deeper, more meaningful way. If you have just 5 minutes to spare, I urge you to watch this brilliant breakdown of Johnny's approach. It's crafted in the most genius way possible, and it's packed with insights that could transform the way you think about storytelling. Speaking of storytelling, let me share another fascinating story I revisited this week. It's from the founder of a film about Ray Kroc, the man who transformed McDonald's into a global empire. There's a pivotal moment in the story when the McDonald brothers realize their 27-item menu is dragging them down. Despite initial success, their driving model was faltering, overwhelmed by inefficiencies and a lack of focus. They realized that 87% of their sales came from just three items: burgers, fries, and Coke. So they took a huge risk. They shut down the restaurant, simplified their menu, and redesigned their operations to focus on these core items. This wasn't just a menu change, it wasn't a complete overhaul of their business model. They got rid of waitresses going to the cars and instead let the customer grab their order directly from the counter, used only paper packages, and the most important cut of all was the waiting, slashing wait times from 30 minutes to 30 seconds. Now imagine having this thriving business and deciding to stop everything one day to make it better. It's a very bold move, because what if that was everything you could ever do? What if that was your best? In that way, you're risking what you have for something imaginary, a very shallow possibility. And the brothers did it, meticulously planning every detail. At first, the new model flopped. Customers were bewildered by the changes, reluctant to adapt. They didn't want to grab their orders from the counters. They wanted waitresses coming to them. But the McDonald brothers persisted, launching their concept with a grand opening, complete with lights, firework, and yes, a few unforeseen disasters, such as flies coming and ruining their grand opening. And as they were discussing going back to the old way, people started coming one after the other, little by little, then just rushing and pouring. The gamble had actually paid off. So many powerful takeaways from the story. The first lesson is to continuously review your work and seek feedback. Avoid becoming complacent and always look for ways to improve. The McDonald brothers could have settled for their average driving model, but instead, they chose to innovate and focus on what truly mattered. The second one is to be bold and embrace innovation, even if it means risking what you currently have. It is very hard, especially when your livelihood depends on it, but you can always revert to the old ways if needed. Well, of course, you should have an emergency revenue or income, but risking it all could actually be worth it. While the journey will have its difficulties, the long-term benefits of taking this risk can be significant. And last but not least, focus on the essentials. And that is definitely a message for me, and maybe for you too. Sometimes less is more. By honing in on their best sellers and optimizing their process, the McDonald brothers created a streamlined, efficient operation that could scale globally. And that's a great way to wrap up this episode, and important lessons that resonated with me. I should definitely do something to focus on the most important things and simply do less, you know? I hope this lesson resonated with you as well. I enjoyed putting this together and sharing the most intriguing insights from this week. I'm already looking forward to uncovering more gems to share with you next time. Thank you so much for tuning in. Goodbye for now, and until next time, take care and chase your hero.